versus Costco Wholesale Corporation, matters before the court for oral argument. On behalf of the appellant, Stephen Anderson will argue. On behalf of the respondent, Neil McFeely. You'll notice some of us are masked and others are not. Those who are masked are actually in the Supreme Court building and pursuant to our emergency rules are wearing their appropriate masks. The rest of us are ensconced in our homes or other bunkers awaiting the passing of the pandemic. Any preliminary matters, Mr. Anderson or Mr. McFeely?
I have one preliminary matter, Your Honor, with the court's indulgence, and that is I'm set up in such a way that if I look at any member of the court on my screen, it will look like I'm looking away. So I'm going to try to remember to look at where my video access point is, but I certainly mean no disrespect to any member of the court if somebody's addressing me and I look like I'm looking away as if I'm not paying attention. It will just be a function of my system right here. So I'll try to remember to do it, but if I don't, I apologize in advance for that.
Oh, that's fine. We're all dealing with different problems with the new normals. So not to worry a bit, Mr. Anderson. Mr. McFeely, anything, sir?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. At this point in time, you may proceed, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice and members of the court. Thank you all for your time this morning. I don't know if I'm going to need my full 20 minutes to talk about this case because I really find it to be very simple in terms of the issues that are presented. We'll see if I'm right or wrong about that. But it is very clear from reading the record and reading the briefing in this case that although the court, I'm sure, faces many complicated issues in cases that it confronts, this case is really not one of them. It can be decided by reaffirming simple, long accepted, and oft repeated concepts. The concepts are, one, that reasonableness in a given tort situation is always a jury question. Two, that foreseeability is a factual inquiry and not a legal one. Three, that a tortfeasor need not foresee the exact mechanism of harm, only a generalized risk of harm. And four, that summary judgment cannot be granted on grounds that the defendant never raised. Those four precepts, I think, would guide the court in its ruling on this particular case today. The district court violated these precepts, making multiple and erroneous factual findings, which the court could not do in the face of a jury demand. Had he been a one-person jury in the case in a court trial, obviously he could have made many of the observations that he made in his summary judgment ruling, and we would be bound by those factual findings. But he is not the jury. If I might just to maybe add some interest to the argument this morning, a slight digression to talk maybe for 60 seconds about another case, not this case. Members of the court may recall that there was a major tragedy in Boise a few years back when, on the occasion of the celebration of the bicentennial of the U.S. Constitution, there was a big celebration held out at the old penitentiary. And it was attended by various dignitaries, including members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Unfortunately, those who remember this, a Wild West stagecoach ride was put up in the pen, put out in the parking lot, and horses collided with cars. They got loose, the horses trampled through many of the participants in the celebration, and there were 20 or 30 people very seriously injured. I tried that case to a jury before Judge McKee, actually. Liability was found, and the whole case centered upon a parking lot design. That is the intermixture of horses and cars. And from that case, I learned, and this case has reaffirmed, that parking lots are not simple things. There are design criteria. They are published or they are known within the industry. They involve things like turning radiuses, blind spots, flow, signage, and pathways. And despite what the district court said in its findings, parking lots are not within the common, ordinary experience of jurors. The parking lots themselves are, of course. You walk through them, but not whether one parking lot design is more safer than another. For in this case, there was an intermixture not of people, not of horses and cars, but of people and cars. and that intermixture can be extremely dangerous and often fatal. And parking lots are the source of many fatalities and many serious injuries if they are not designed correctly. Here, in this case, Mr. Oswald was innocently taking his Costco purchases back to his car, walking on the designated sidewalk, and never noticed the several design flaws that would cost him his health and his mobility and nearly his life. Yes, there was a car involved in this collision as well, that is, collision with him, but controlling and mitigating where cars go, how they park, at what speeds, and in what designated areas is the very reason for parking lot design. So, members of the court, this is a straightforward premises liability case. It is. It alleges that there was a failure to maintain the premises in a reasonably safe condition. Summary judgment was moved by a Costco, and they argued, it was more than this, but they basically argued that it was a safe parking lot because it was ADA compliant. They did not move that there was no duty to protect against foreseeable risks. Our response to that summary judgment motion was as vanilla and garden variety as one can imagine. We presented two highly qualified plants experts who opined that the parking lot was not designed and maintained in a safe way. That is, it was not reasonably safe for its anticipated uses. I don't know if the court's had an opportunity to look at the expert reports, but if I can just highlight them real quickly, and they're found in the record at page 139.
I do have one question in that regard, Mr. Anderson.
Yes, sir.
In this case, your expert talks about bollards, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's right.
Bollards as well as curbs, as well as appropriate parking barriers. Here, the defendant had ADA restrictions on some of those safety precautions, i.e. the height of the vehicle stops, i.e. the fact that they could not have a curb because wheelchairs had to come up. And in addition, is there any type, when you're dealing with an ADA compliant parking spot, where you must have X amount of feet on each side of an automobile, wheelchair accessible, for a car that tries to park on the striped area, which seems to be what happened in this case? Is that foreseeable at all?
Yes, because, our argument is, Chief Justice, that, first of all, basic principles apply. One is that the mechanism of injury need not be foreseen, and in most cases is not foreseen. What is foreseen, what foreseeable is there not a risk of harm to patrons or risk of harm to people? Can you foresee that or can you not? Typically, that is established by showing in this particular case, it would also be true that there is absolutely no protection of any kind, no barrier of any kind between the pedestrians and the cars that are parking there. And it's undisputed really on the record that the people who are parking there are people who present a unique and ascertainable risk because they are handicapped drivers. Some of those people are blind. Some of them have, lacking a limb. That doesn't mean anything about whether they should be driving or not. It simply means that they present an additional risk. So to Your Honor's question about the striped area between, there is a factual question in the case exactly how Mr. Meyer, who was the gentleman that was driving the car, had his incursion into the pedestrian area. He was in the striped area, but that's after he had bounced off a car to get there. So that all has to be reconstructed, and there are factual inquiries. But can it be made safe from incursions and still maintain ADA compliance? Absolutely, yes. Typically what they do, and this is again is laid out in the reports, is you'll put either one large bollard or two side-by-side bollards with the handicap sign on top of them. That leaves plenty of room for a wheelchair to go around the bollards and onto the sidewalk. If you're going to have a sidewalk without a curb or without any barriers, then you have to have those bollards there. And in fact, as we've shown and the records show, bollards are typically used in not only Costco parking lots, but all other retail parking lots to protect things like air conditioning equipment or the entrance to the store.
Oh, I agree.
Mr. Anderson, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The one thing that struck me as I read Mr. Reeder's report and his CV and also the report and CV of your human factors fellow, the plaintiffs in this case don't have an expert engineer who has testified regarding the reasonableness of this design at all. As I looked at Mr. Reeder's qualifications, he's got a BA from, I think, the University of California. He's certainly involved in the use of safety devices to protect from intrusions into the front of storefronts. But explain why he's qualified to offer opinions on this topic about whether this was an appropriate design or not.
Well, you know, to be honest, Your Honor, I'd need to go back and look at his qualifications. I think they're laid out clearly in his report. I know that he is involved in parking lot design issues around the country, so I'm not quite sure if there's. I mean, I don't know if he has certifications in parking lot design or anything, but there aren't such things as I am aware. These are just people who understand both human factors and, you know, basic ingress and egress issues with respect to cars in parking lots. So I think he's qualified. I can't say that his qualifications were never an issue below. That is, no one ever said that he was not qualified and couldn't opine on the issues that he opined. Costco took a completely different tact in attempting to strike the opinions of these experts, saying that they, you know, were either not relevant or they were legal conclusions or something like that, but nobody attacked Mr. Ryder's qualifications. Dr. Alexander's qualifications are certainly impeccable. He's one of the leading human factors experts in this state, probably the leading. He's hard to get. And he is an expert in the design of, you know, safety warnings and vehicle design and road design and parking lot design. I think those are laid out in his report.
Mr. Anderson, on the issue of foreseeability, my understanding from the facts and the record are that this driver, Mr. Meyer, it's undisputed, probably shouldn't have been driving in the first place. I think he had his driving privileges restored, but they were on a restricted basis. I'm just wondering how foreseeable it is that someone that shouldn't be driving then causes an accident, what we expect of the property owner. For example, if a child was driving a car or there was a drunk driver or you have an elderly man that really shouldn't have been driving, how does that affect the foreseeability analysis?
It does not. And the reason it does not, Your Honor, is because, thank you for the question, because I think that is exactly where the district court got off base. You do not have to foresee the exact way in which somebody is going to be injured. It could very well be, I could think of a 100 other possibilities. Somebody could be driving, having a temporary handicap sticker because they have a cast on their leg and their foot slips off the pedal. And then one would ask, well, how foreseeable is it that Costco would know that a guy with a broken leg is driving a car with a handicap sticker? And the answer is probably not at all. The question is, are handicapped individuals parking there? Yes. Do they present an increased risk? Yes. Do they create an increased risk in parking scenarios? Yes. That's the kind of thing that affects the foreseeability analysis, not whether Mr. Myers in particular had his driving privileges revoked or he should have been driving at all. Basically, what you have there is you have folks that are handicapped. They just simply present a greater risk. They just do. But even then, even if it wasn't the handicapped area at all, and you just simply had people who were not suffering any disabilities parking in that same area. It would still be dangerous because you're aiming the cars at the people that are walking there. And we all know that there's incursions into sidewalks and that sort of thing when people lose control of their vehicles. The very thing that you are trying to protect against with bollards is that people might lose control of their vehicles because people are walking right in front of them up and down that sidewalk thousands of times a day. So it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about the ADA guidelines. My understanding is the ADA guidelines were intended to protect the people who have disabilities, not necessarily intended to protect the public. Should the court or anybody have relied upon the ADA guidelines to set some kind of standard of care in this case?
No, and another good question, Your Honor, thank you. Actually, the district court had already found below that the ADA guideline compliance was not a basis for excusing liability. That is, ADA guidelines are there to present opportunities for ingress and egress by folks who are suffering from disabilities. Really nothing more. They're complicated, but they're in no way intended to foreclose an inquiry into whether or not the design was safe or unsafe because it was ADA compliant. One has nothing to do with the other. So, I was saying, Your Honors, that if you look at the summary of the conclusions from Dr. Alexander that are contained on in the record on pages 1408 and 1409. In summary, these opinions are that handicapped and aged individuals present a greater risk for driving driving hazards. This is undisputed. That Mr. Meyer fit those characteristics. And that Costco, by their specific walkway, funneled human traffic onto the walkway, offering a seemingly safe passage, but it was not. And fifth and sixth, he said, Costco, by their design and operation, and I'm quoting here, of the Boise Costco parking area, provided no protection and unacceptably high risks to the pedestrians in the walkway, given that it was adjacent to a handicapped parking area. And finally, that alternative parking lot safety features and devices were available, which would have eliminated a high foreseeable risk of hazard, namely injury or fatality, by use of back barriers, bollards, or parking lot redesign. Now, there's just no way in the world that those can be characterized as legal conclusions. They are not. They are engineering opinions expressed by someone who says, look, this premises is unsafe, and here are the reasons why, and here are the standards that are violated. The district court struck those opinions, saying that they were either legal conclusions, one, which they are certainly not, or two, they are within the common knowledge of jurors, which they are not, because jurors don't understand parking lot design or human factors.
One of the questions I had about Judge Scott's decision as far as his determination that it was within the grasp of the ordinary juror, doesn't that seem that the conclusions that were drawn by your expert create a question of fact as far as that issue is concerned by drawing that conclusion?
Yes, and thank you for the question, Art. The analysis on summary judgment is, have we created a question of fact that requires jury determination? And that's done, whether it's a premises case or a products case or a professional liability case, by experts who say these are the standards, whether published or accepted within the industry, and these standards were violated. That does not mean anyone was negligent. That's the ultimate question. It does not mean anybody necessarily should be liable. That's an ultimate question. What they established for the jury is that there are standards which, in their opinion, were not met. That's standard fare in every professional liability premise or products case. And that's all these experts were attempting to do in their affidavits, is raise a question of fact so that the judge could make the correct decision, which is to say, well, even if I wouldn't be a good juror for you, the judge might say, but there's 12 other people who might disagree with me, and in view of the jury demand, that's where it has to go. So as an example, my time will run out. His Honor, in the below decision, cited the standard for foreseeability. And he stated on page 16 of his decision that where the degree of harm is great, but preventing it is not difficult, a relatively low degree of foreseeability is required. But where the threatened injury is minor, but the burden of preventing is high, then a higher degree of foreseeability may be required. And that's an absolutely correct statement of the law. The problem is that that is a jury instruction. That is a stock jury instruction in premises liability cases, so that the jury can go back and say, well, it would have cost $1 million to have prevented this particular injury because they would have had to completely redesign the parking lot. Or it would only cost $100 to install these bollards. And so if the risk of injury is high, which it was in this case, and the cost of preventing it is low, foreseeability less foreseeability is required of the exact thing that happened. That's what jurors debate. And they debate that with the guidance of a jury instruction, such as the one cited by the district court. The problem is that the district court went on to say, well, I'm not convinced because one, there aren't any other incidents that ever happened on that location, which is an argument that one could make, presumably. And he says that belies the concept of any particular harm there. Well, does it belie it or does it not? The question is not for the judge. That question is for the jury, based upon the evidence that we would present of other flight facilities, of the costs of installing safety barriers, of the standards that existed, and whether or not the designers of the parking lot took these factors into account or did not. That is the sort of evidence that the jury would be entitled to consider. So we're asking, Your Honors, that I haven't talked about discovery in this case, but certainly the case should be remanded. And Mr. Roswell should be allowed to present his case to a jury because there are material questions of fact here based on the affidavits of the experts and the other facts that are in the record. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. McFeely.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Burdick, members of the court, Madam Clerk, counsel, may I please the court, I represent Costco Wholesale Corporation. And in this case, plaintiffs are asking you not just to overrule and overturn the well-reasoned decision of the district judge, but is really asking you to overturn 100 years of case law that a shopkeeper is not the insurer of its invitees. They're asking you to overturn the 2018 case in Johnson versus Walmart that says that something more is needed to impose liability on a shopkeeper, something more than the mere fact of an accident and the mere fact that, or the mere knowledge that an accident could possibly occur, even if it is not foreseeable. They're basically asking you to find that owners of stores, shopkeepers, have a duty to impose impregnable barriers where between vehicles and potential pedestrians at all locations in the parking lot, or perhaps preclude elderly and or disabled people from even driving in that parking lot, because we're talking about driving into the parking lot, driving over pedestrian walkways, we're talking about parking in other areas. So they are asking you to give up your, or asking the courts to give up your gatekeeping roles and allow all accidents to be litigated under a strict liability standard. And that's not Idaho's standard. And that's, I don't believe, where the court should go. You're aware of the factual background of the case, and obviously from your questions, you know how this accident occurred. The elderly and over 90 years old gentleman, Mr. Myers, who had had his driver's license revoked, but was for some reason allowed to drive in a very circumscribed, actually he was allowed to drive to Costco and to another store. That was the extent that he was able to drive. Instead of walking, allowing pedestrians just to walk in the parking lot and get out of cars and go between cars, Costco did indeed have a sidewalk or a clearly designated walkway in that parking lot.
Well, wait a second. They didn't do that out of their beneficial interest. They did it because the federal government said ADA compliant, you must have these things.
I don't believe you had to have a walkway. You need to have accessible access to the store. The whole theory that plaintiffs are alleging is that Costco on its own intentionally funneled pedestrians through this walkway. So they're saying they funnel these pedestrians. Well, instead of funneling those pedestrians, it's not just in front of the ADA parking spaces, but there's also an extension of that walkway. Costco created that walkway so people wouldn't have to just walk through the parking lot, at least in that area of the store.
I think Mr. Anderson's argument was a little more nuanced than that. He's suggesting not only did they funnel them there, but they funneled them into an area where drivers, perhaps because of their disabilities, are more dangerous for the public to be around. Do you agree with that factual assertion?
Well, no, and I don't believe that even the record supports that. The record says that people under 20 some years old are bad drivers, maybe bad drivers that have foot faults, if you will, and that old elderly people have foot faults or pedal errors, excuse me. There's nothing that really is in the record that says disabled people per se have more of a chance to have pedal errors. And there isn't really any proof here that there was a per se, quote, pedal area. Instead, in the record or in the answer, Mr. Meyer's attorneys acknowledge, or the Mr. Meyer acknowledges that he was negligent by not knowing whether to put it into reverse or into drive. That's what his answer states. So I don't think there's necessarily in the record to back that up. But again, I don't know that that's necessarily an issue as to whether disabled people may have more chance of causing or having a pedal error.
Not every large shopping area, such as the ones at Costco, have a pedestrian path that goes through the middle of the disabled parking area. Should the plaintiff's experts been allowed to opine on whether or not that was a safe practice or a negligent practice?
Your Honor, I think that the court below made the appropriate decision. I mean, the reality is that plaintiffs won on our motion to exclude their experts based on non-qualification, based on hearsay, all of those things. They won everything except the very narrow and I think, you know, just generally accepted argument or doctrine that experts cannot opine on legal matters, nor can they opine on matters that a jury would be able to determine. And I think that those things as to, well, the foreseeability of such an accident and the fact that the sidewalk was unduly dangerous, I think those fit within the narrow parameters that Judge Scott decided.
When does the court allow, typically duty questions are matters of law. In some instances, foreseeability can be a question of fact. What's the line between the cases where it's decided as a matter of law and where the court allows a jury to consider the issue?
I think that line was drawn in the Johnson versus Walmart case, Your Honor. And I think, and I know that you've read Judge Scott's decision carefully, and he very carefully defined and delineated what that standard is.
Wasn't the issue in Walmart? Nobody knew how the liquid got there. There was no liquid in the aisle. There was no liquid around, and there was no videotape or testimony or anything else about how it got on the floor.
I think the major issue in the Johnson, the Walmart case was the plaintiffs claimed that, well, Walmart knew that people, that there was a general generic danger of liquids in stores. And they also had a policy of checking to see, you know, to have people go through on floor walks to see if there was water on the floor. So the argument was, well, that's foreseeable. The argument was that that it's foreseeable that somebody dropped and therefore they should be able to continue. I think this court affirmed the lower court's decision that there has to be something more than simply the fact of an accident, the fact that you can, you know, that people drive cars and cars, I take it out of Walmart, that people drop water in the store, and that there's even a policy in the Walmart that we should check for spills on the store. So I think that's the heart of the Walmart case, is not just that nobody knew, but in this case, I mean, if you want to take it back to this case, nobody in Costco Boise knew 14 years of this design, of this opening of the store, based on the expert's own opinions or their factual argument. There were some 17 million people that traversed that sidewalk. And there's no proof, because there has been no comparable, similar accident in that area. So we're talking about 14 years of safe usage. We're talking about 17 million members, shoppers who've gone there. So I think that's an important issue of foreseeability duty requires that foreseeability in premises liability cases. And again, I want to clarify, and I know that you've read the record, and I don't mean to be redundant, but Mr. Myers, the 92-year-old man, didn't just pull into a parking spot and, you know, bump into the wheel stop or run over the sign. He came into that crosshatched access parking spot that nobody is supposed to, I mean, non-parking spot. He didn't just drive into that and drive across. He ran into a car that was parked on the east side of that and ran all the way down the side of that car, pushing that car out of the parking spot, and then crossed over the access crosshatched space into the walkway. And I recognize, and I know this is a horrible accident for Mr. Oswald, but that's the background of the case. And as Judge Scott said, I mean, and that was the, as you, and I know you've read the complaint. The complaint points to Mr. Myers and says he did all these things that were negligent and improper and reckless and so on. And Myers' counsel agreed admitted. Yes, he was negligent, but in putting his car into reverse or drive. And as Judge Scott mentioned, well, it was certainly expected that they would sue Mr. Myers and his estate as he died later, but it was quite somewhat surprising that they would sue Costco. In any event, if I may, let me deal with the discovery issues that you've touched on. The first one that really hasn't been discussed is this protective order for the question as to the scope of discovery as to prior accidents. And what we're talking here entirely is the first set of discovery. And that first set of discovery the objectionable parts, the plaintiff's discovery asks for accidents or a discovery that were vehicular accidents, which were any contact between a vehicle and any other object, including a person or inanimate object, such as a signpost, a bollard, a planter, a building, a shopping cart, a tree, or a parking bumper or wheel stop, as well as vehicular incursions, which is any vehicular incursion into an area in which vehicles are not intended to be, including pedestrian walkways, eating or sitting areas in the interior of a building. So plaintiff was basically asking for, and again, and also they were asking for the past 10 to 11 years of all Costco stores in the world. So that's the scope of the discovery dispute that you have before you on that motion for protective order.
So I read the district court's ruling at the hearing on the motion for protective order. And what I understood the district court to say was that the requests for discovery were overly broad. And I've read overly broad many times, probably used it myself in some discovery answers. But where does that analysis of being overly broad, where does it fit in the context of Rule 26? I mean, why is it objectionable? Where does overly broad fit? I mean, if you look at Rule 26, it says on motion or on its own, the court must limit the frequency or extent of discovery otherwise allowed by these rules if it determines that it's unreasonably cumulative or duplicative. There's some other less burdensome or less expensive way. You can get it somewhere else. How does overly broad fit in?
Well, I think it's not just a question of overly broad, but overly broad in the context of what's the discoverable information is information that can reasonably lead to the discovery of admissible information. Whether a car ran into a shopping cart at the Costco in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, or Santa Clara, California, or in Japan, that's not relevant to the question of before this court.
But that's not the standard for discovery, is it? Relevance?
Standard for discovery is if it's reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. And our argument was, and the court's holding was, this really isn't reasonably calculated to get to anything that would be admissible in this case.
But I didn't read that in the district court's colloquy. I read the district court to be saying, I read the phrase overly broad multiple times, but never any analysis of was it outside the scope of discovery that you've articulated that it's, I think a standard that it was out of scope. But I didn't read that in the district court's analysis, and I didn't read any analysis of the request being overly burdensome to Costco.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that the court in its colloquy did state to the effect that just because an accident occurred somewhere, there's that was not part of this, necessarily part of this case. That's why he suggested that discovery be narrowed down, and that it was not just overly burdensome, but it was not reasonably calculated to lead to anything that could be appropriate in this case. That's what he talked about, the something more. It's not just that an accident occurred somewhere on some Costco parking space. And again, this wasn't, their request wasn't even just for Costco accidents, not even just Costco pedestrian, it wasn't even motor vehicle pedestrian accidents. It wasn't just Costco accidents in general. They asked for any retail store, knowledge of any retail store.
But counsel, I just wonder if the correct standard is just as Brody has indicated is applied. Rule 26 talks about the discovery of evidence that would be admissible at trial, and it makes it clear that the discovery doesn't have to be, that sought doesn't have to be admissible at trial. It just has to lead to further evidence that would be admissible at trial. So I'm assuming this is a type of information that the plaintiffs wanted for their experts to analyze, and the result of their analysis could have led to admissible evidence at trial. And I think that's an important distinction. Did the court properly apply that distinction?
Yes, Your Honor, and respectfully, I would say that whether there was a, whether the expert knew that there were 10 motor vehicle accidents that included bumping into a shopping cart or backing out of a parking space and running into another car, that wouldn't be admissible, and that wouldn't be anything that would inform the opinion of the expert. And I think that's where we're talking about with the judge's decision on that discovery dispute.
It's always dangerous to speculate what an expert needs to know to reach their conclusions. Was there anything factual to support that? For example, I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this either, but it would just seem to me the type of information an expert might want to see would generally be much broader than the type of evidence that would be admissible at trial.
Your Honor, I think we have to recognize back to the point that what plaintiff's whole theory was, it wasn't that cars shouldn't be allowed in parking lots in general or Costco parking lots or in specific. They're saying that this unique design of this particular type of a walkway between ADA compliant spots funneled people where older and disabled drivers could hit them. That's their theory. That was what their theory was in their complaint. That's what their theory was throughout this case. That's what their theory is defined as in their pleadings here under their briefing as well. That's what they were talking about. This particular Costco, this particular design. So I don't mean to be disrespectful, but what difference does their expert, why would it be important for their expert to know whether there were motor vehicle accidents backing out of a parking lot throughout the entire country, throughout the entire world on Costco parking lots? Why would it be relevant or discoverable or admissible that there were, as I said, that there was any contact between a vehicle in a signpost or a planter or anything such as that? Is the court has some, obviously the trial courts have some significant discretion in that decision.
Don't you think though, Mr. McFeely, and I don't want to speak for Mr. Anderson, but don't you think if there had been evidence showing that more grocery carts or more signposts were hit near handicapped areas or disabled areas than in other parts of the parking lot, that could be extrapolated to suggest that the public was at risk in those areas too?
I don't think that's necessarily correct, Your Honor, but the discovery could have been certainly narrowed to that area. There wasn't, it wasn't narrowed in that original, and we're talking about what the specific requests were. It wasn't narrowed to anything by ADA parking lots or even with disabled persons. So
think an expert, if they had the universe of accidents in a parking lot, could look at the data in a granular way and suggests that certain areas of a parking lot are higher risk than others.
I don't think that in that discovery it asked the in those terms. It asked about generic accidents in every parking lot that Costco has in the United States and my recollection around the world.
So it just wasn't, this request wasn't crafted to get to that type of information?
No, it wasn't. And again, we went and we asked meet and confer and they, and it wasn't narrowed. And then we moved to compel, moved for protective order. And then only after that point did they try to make the, we had a second round of discovery after this protective order was granted and we and council agreed and we narrowed it down and we answered those things. So the only thing that for this court is that one very broad scope of discovery.
Isn't that moot if in fact the plaintiff reduced the request and they were answered?
That was going to be my final argument on this part of that it may well be moot because they did come with a second set of discovery and they didn't, and we answered, and after discussion, meet and confers, we did answer the questions that they had as to whether there were, certain types of accidents.
A stipulation in regard to that, or was that the discovery was obtained by Oswald? Was that everything that the plaintiff asked for at that juncture?
Your Honor, after the court's decision on motion for protective order, then plaintiffs came back with a second set of discovery, somewhat narrowed. We had a meet and confer, and between counsel, we agreed we would answer certain scope. We answered that. They never brought another, they didn't bring a motion to compel. They didn't bring this to the attention of the district court. So I don't think that's, so I think that that's the scope that we are in. They never, they don't have any current, if you will, complaint about what was provided.
So if you're denied discovery on the basis that you've asked for too much, you narrow it down to something that the party, that the adverse party is willing to answer, you've therefore waived your request for the greater scope of discovery?
No, Your Honor, I didn't mean to say that when I was talking about mootness. I'm saying anything else is moot because the only thing before this court is the original requests.
Right, but I guess as I think about mootness, it's more like, well, it doesn't matter anymore. And my point is, doesn't it matter? I mean, if the plaintiff was improperly denied a larger scope of discovery?
I think it does matter what the original request was, and that's what we've been arguing about. That original request requested everything about all parking lots, about all retail stores.
Okay, so it's not moot.
Well, that part is not moot, but anything else there? I mean, their argument is not just their argument, as far as I recall in their brief, didn't even lay out what those requests were. They were talking about, they were saying, oh, we need more information about this, blah, 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 not about the specific original request. That was intended to be my response, Your Honor.
Mr. McFeely, did Judge Scott limit the plaintiff's request for discovery to the risk management files of Costco?
He said, "What? Again, this was part of the burdensome thing about that we wouldn't have to go to." So the answer is yes. The
concerned about that because if there are what I would consider to be smoking gun incidents, and it's not contained in the risk management file, how does one ever discover that smoking gun?
Well, I guess I'm not sure what the court means about the smoking gun. But
let's say there's an identical accident that put Costco on notice that this was a dangerous instrumentality at its facilities, and that they should have known that thereafter there were going to be incidents like this.
Well, I guess the question is, how does a defendant, let's suppose that the plaintiffs had indeed asked for specific kinds of incidents in comparable places, which was, you know, what our argument was. The only way that we could, you know, find out whether there was something else, I mean, wherever, is through, well, the only realistic way to find that out would be through the risk management database. I don't know. I mean, were we going to be required to write to each of the thousand or hundreds of Costcos? So I think that the, you know, and again, the risk management database has to do, relates to everything any accident that occurred. I don't know from practicality what else could have been, how else defendants could have found that information.
Well, having represented institutions in the past, I know that sometimes we would overlook information that was originally asked for because it wasn't kept in a certain place. And just because it's not kept in the risk management file doesn't mean that there's not an identical accident out there that happened that didn't make its way into the risk management file. And how is a plaintiff to know that it has all of the information if the institution is determining what goes into its file?
I don't know how I could represent to the court and how I could sign off on a discovery response that said, I have checked every Costco. I mean, the only way to do that is to go back to the institution and request their information. And that's what Judge Scott was saying needed to be done, is to check the Costco, if you will, risk management or corporate information as to the narrowed down scope of discovery. I believe my time is up, Your Honor.
Correct. Thank you, sir. How much time does the appellate have?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you very much, Chief Justice. Comments concerning some things that Mr. McFeely said. First of all, I do appreciate him reminding me of something that Justice Brody raised, which is that there was a challenge to the qualifications of the experts. Those were overruled at the district court. So qualifications really was not anything that anyone raised as far as this either appeal is concerned or the summary judgment. Let me talk about Johnson versus Walmart for just a moment. The something more requirement in that setting is unique to that setting because spills are always a new spill in a new location. So what the court was saying there is you can't be an insurer of everything that goes on in the store without something more than just the fact that there is a spill, because it's a new one every time. And that's what Johnson stands for. This case is not that. This case is a non-latent, recurring, and continuous defect. So there is no question that Costco has notice of this condition. What they're saying is we didn't realize it was dangerous, if that's what they are arguing. However, that is a factual question. And in particular, on the issue of pedal error, one should be able to ask the question of Costco, are you aware of the concept of pedal error? Because these are incredibly common. These happen all the time. I don't know if I've ever done it, but you read about it in these journals and it's incredibly common. So are you aware of it? And if so, then what did you do to prevent it? If not, what kind of studies did you undertake to understand whether or not there is a risk of that sort of thing happening in your parking lot and how did you prevent it? Those are all factual questions. And so it is not the place of the district judge to say, as he did in his decision, that it's not foreseeable, because that's belied by the absence of any prior vehicle incursions on this walkway during its 14-year history on page 15 of his decision. That's an argument that might be able to be made at court. I would move in limine to prevent any statistical type analysis like that. But at the very least, the court, I think, has to agree that the judge there was making a factual argument on behalf of Costco, that it wasn't foreseeable because history didn't indicate it. However, other things might be an indicator of that danger besides just the fact that no one had been unlucky like Mr. Oswald yet. And those would have included things like other parking lot incidents that were similar at other stores. Costco's are not independently owned and operated. It is one corporate entity. And what we were trying to do to follow up on some of the court's questions about discovery is we were trying to ask the very basic question, how often has something like this happened before? That standard fare in this type of litigation, whether it is boxes tumbling down or whether it is slippages on the floor or whether it is parking lot incidents, you always ask, how many times has this happened before at other similar locations that you are aware of? And what Judge Scott did in the case of the discovery, this was to say this was stonewall discovery is an understatement. Costco simply would not give us anything. And they took us to court on every single request and every single interrogatory and said, we're not going to give you this information. And eventually what happened is the trial court narrowed the request down to something like any other incidents that are identical to this one, basically. Handicapped driver, an elderly driver incurred having an incursion into a pedestrian area that is adjacent to the ADA area. That's not what you would ask. You would say, how many times have there been parking lot accidents at all? Do you have a safety department that deals with these things? Do they have internal standards and what steps did they take? That's what would be tried. Those are all factual issues. And Judge Scott unfairly narrowed us to something that was virtually identical. The whole battle on the discovery front is laid out in the appellate briefing, so I won't go beyond it other than to say that, yes, we certainly did not waive our request for every other thing that was like this having happened in the past, because that's how the cases are built. What we did do is follow up with secondary discovery that said, well, given those limitations, at least give us that information, which naturally came back with a zero. No, we've never had anything like this happen before. But other things have happened like it. We just know that because they're in the record. They're in some publications. They're in some other litigations. And we did what we could with that at the trial court level to show, look, there's something here, Your Honor. We're entitled to full discovery, but we didn't get it.
Mr. Anderson, discovery matters are discretionary on the part of the trial court. So articulate where the district court went wrong using the Lunenborg abuse of discretion standards.
Yes, so, and we argue this in the brief, Your Honor, that it was an abuse of discretion because Your Honor is exactly right. It's discretionary with the trial court and has to be because this court can't take its time on every single discovery matter. What we were saying there is that if what you're going to do is you're going to hold us to, and that's the reason I read that section that said it's belied by the absence of other accidents or other similar incidents. That was something that the court used in his analysis to deny any access to the jury at all. And so what we're saying the abuse of discretion there is, well, you have to have a reasoned decision for that. And Your Honor pointed out, and I think it's absolutely true, that the court did really zero analysis of the Rule 26 standard. And I think that's an abuse of discretion. The court can at least put a couple of sentences in about why he thinks that the burden is too great or why he thinks that the information requested is not relevant. Instead, what the court did is forego any analysis at all and simply say that it has to be identical or it's not relevant. And the issue of relevancy, as a couple of the justices have mentioned today, is a much broader standard than it is whether it's going to end up being relevant for purposes of admission at trial. And so that is why, for instance, in the Walmart case that everyone's familiar with here and the Costco case where boxes tumbled and fell on people, there were huge discovery battles there about how many other times this has happened. And the answer was always, well, it wasn't similar. It wasn't the same. And those are always decided on the liberal level, which is, well, look, give them the information and see what they can make out of it. In this case, we were given no information, one, and two, we were given no analysis from the district court at all as to why we were not entitled to that information. And that's why we say it was an abuse of discretion, because there has to be a reasoned basis stated in the decision, and there was not. Further, I think that the suggestion that there are implications of this decision, such as what Mr. McFeely was saying, is, well, we would be requiring these retail establishments to be the insurers of all of everybody who goes there, or we are precluding elderly people from coming into the parking lots. These are the sorts of things that the trial court also raised in its decision, which is the implications of this decision for other type of situations where people are parking and they're either elderly or handicapped or something like that. None of that has any bearing on the case. What has a bearing on the case is whether there is a material question of fact in response to the summary judgment arguments that were raised, that there is no breach here. We claim there is. And they have an expert who said, no, this is a perfectly well-designed parking lot. I'm not saying it's apparent to everyone that this is a problem or a flaw or a design defect. It is not. They have an expert who says, oh, no, this is a very well-designed parking lot. That's going to be for the jury to decide. It'll be based on how I cross-examine that expert and the facts that we adduce, including whether or not there are other similar incidents that have happened at other Costco establishments. And yes, it is definitely not limited to Idaho or to Boise. It is any Costco establishment where they have architects and designers that put these parking lots together, and did they or did they not take into account known or should have known risks? Because there is no debate in the appellant's briefing, in our briefing, or in Costco's briefing that should have known is the standard. That is a factual question based upon what we can adduce and prove about the state of the knowledge of parking lot design, and coupled with knowledge of accidents that have happened in Costco facilities or Costco sites that are similar to this. And Costco can move to exclude those because they're not sufficiently similar. That is a typical relevancy objection, but we don't know what those are yet because those were not given to us. So in summary, Your Honors, and again, thank you very much for your time today. This is a garden variety premises liability case where the premises is defective according to our allegations and our proof. That is a factual matter for the jury to determine. It cannot be taken away by a court who strikes our expert opinions based upon the fact that they are legal conclusions, which they are certainly not. And that is why I am saying it has to be done in accordance with old principles that have been around for many, many decades. Thank you very much, members of the court.
Thank you. At this time, the matter is under advisement. We will issue an opinion. Thanks to counsel.
Thank you.